Okay, so we've got a theme of mindfulness the last few weeks. And what I thought I would do this week is to look at the way that mindfulness was presented as a meditation subject in early Buddhism, which is more interesting than it sounds, actually. But before doing that, I just thought I'd say something a bit more general about mindfulness, about just how completely central it is in Buddhism. But in my opinion, it's completely central in human life. Because being aware, being there while it happens, is what makes it worthwhile. If you miss it, then you've lost it. You know, that's what it seems to me. So to be there while it happens means being aware of your life, of your experience. And I think there's only one reason that we don't do that, because after all, as human beings, we have the capacity to do that. It's because sometimes when we turn our awareness to what's going on, we don't really like it very much. It's not quite what we want, you know. And so therefore our mind, instead of that, starts dwelling on the way we would like things to be, or even the way we're afraid of it going even more wrong, and that kind of thing tends to happen, or on our own inadequacies and all that sort of thing. So the secret of mindfulness seems to be being prepared to stay with what's happening, even when you don't really like it. If you can do that, paradoxically enough, life becomes much more rewarding, because you're there for the good things and you're there for the not so good things, but you're there for it while it happens. And gradually you can come to terms with those dual reactions, sometimes welcoming your experience, sometimes rejecting it, until you find you don't need to do that anymore. You find that that's to do with a limited view of yourself and your life. And then everything can be, in a sense, rewarding. I think rewarding is the best word. So the Buddha really stressed this. He said this is very valuable. And he said, be as mindful as you can. And he soon realized, from his own personal experience, that it wasn't enough just to exhort people to be mindful, in the same way as it's not enough just to exhort people to be kind and nice to each other. In a way, you need some training. And so meditation is the training in mindfulness and in kindness. That's what meditation is for. And he pushed, in particular, mindfulness meditation. He probably stressed that more than any other form of meditation. There are many forms, and of course they all involve mindfulness, but this is where you're actually cultivating mindfulness. And he particularly stressed the mindfulness of breathing. And according to some accounts, the mindfulness of breathing is the meditation that he was doing when he finally sat down under the Bodhi tree for that push, that last push towards enlightenment. And he said it was the meditation that was particularly valuable for dealing with mental distractions and mental disturbances. So if you ever have any distractions or disturbances, the mindfulness of breathing might be the meditation for you. If you don't have any, then you might want to concentrate on another kind of meditation instead. But if you do, I suggest you go for mindfulness of breathing. And it's also a very advanced practice. It's a very beginner practice and it's a very advanced practice. And there is one of the many suttas in the Pali Canon, Majjhima Nikaya, number 118, which is called the Sutta, the text of the mindfulness of breathing. This is a copy of it here. Anapanasati. So Anapanasati. Breathing in, breathing out, mindfulness. That's what that means. Breathing in, breathing out, mindfulness. It's very clear. And in this sutta, there's a bit of a scene setting that goes on at the beginning. And what's happening is the Buddha is with quite a few of his own followers, and they're all on retreat together. And every year they would spend the rainy season on retreat. And the rainy season was drawing to a close. And he was looking around and he was realizing that the Sangha was really thriving. He was seeing people doing all sorts of kinds of meditation. And they weren't just doing it. They were in groups, and the more experienced ones were teaching and helping, the less experienced ones giving guidance, meditation, interviews, and so on. There's a little account of all these different things going on. And he looked around and he saw all these meditations, and the sutta lists all the different meditations that were being practiced on this retreat. And he looked around and he saw that quite a few people were doing mindfulness of breathing meditation, which he'd already been encouraging. And he thought, these people are keen. They like meditation. They want to explore meditation. So I'm going to give them a treat. and I'm going to explain how one can use mindfulness of breathing to take you all the way to enlightenment. So that's why he taught this sutta, the in-breathing and out-breathing sutta. He taught it to extend the practice of mindfulness of breathing so that it wasn't just a mindfulness practice, but it was also an insight practice. It was also a practice that took you all the way to awakening, to enlightenment. And so I'm not going to go through the whole of the text. I'm going to go through what seems to me to be the core of the text, which is 16 different ways of practicing mindfulness of breathing. And this is quite a lot, and probably not all of it will be relevant to all of you. So I hope you'll bear with me while I just go through some of them. And I think I'm going to suggest that if you've got any questions or comments, you come out with them straight away. Because with so many different topics, asking you to remember it until the end is a little bit much, I think. So do just chip in if you want to ask any questions. And I'm going to go through, and we went through quite a lot of this downstairs when I led you through a sequence of Anapanasati, which one can do as one sequential meditation, although you need to have the kind of mind that can sort of cope with quite a lot of things to do in your meditation. It doesn't necessarily suit everybody. And so other people would maybe home in on one small part of this and just do that. And in fact, the normal mindfulness of breathing we do is basically the first four stages, the first four of these 16 types of meditation. And just one other thing I want to say about this is that in the sutta and elsewhere, these 16 are related to mindfulness in general, in particular something that Yashobodhi mentioned, the foundations of mindfulness. But I have a suspicion that when this was first taught, it wasn't actually connected with the foundations of mindfulness. It was an independent teaching of its own. So I'm not going to mention the way it connects with the foundations of mindfulness, which is mindfulness of the body, of the feelings, of mental states, and of the objects of the mind. And if you're interested in that, come on the city retreat, and that will be the theme on the city retreat, looking at those foundations of mindfulness. Okay, so before I start looking at some of these, which I hope you'll find useful and interesting, has anyone got any comments or questions at this stage?
Actually, just when you were talking about not finding what you were mindful of terribly, what you wanted to be mindful
yes.
of, it's really a question of judging, is it? Because if you don't judge it as good or bad, then you don't immediately start trying to change it. If one thinks of an unpleasant situation, thinks of ways of getting out of it.
Yes.
Whereas in fact, if you get to the stage where you don't think things are pleasant or unpleasant,
I should say that is quite a big ask.
Right.
You know, to actually not find things pleasant or unpleasant
right.
is something which you may sometimes get to that point, but I'll admire you enormously if you manage
right.
to do that all the time. Because the fact is that it's almost visceral sometimes, isn't it? You know, if somebody at work is a little bit narky with us,
yes.
we don't sort of necessarily think, now, how shall I respond to this? Shall I appreciate it and say, yes, fine, or shall I not? It happens from down here somewhere, doesn't it? You know. So that's why, at first at least, I think one has to say, actually, I don't like this. Let's face it. I want to avoid this. I want to get away from this. But I'm going to see if I can just sit with it, sit through the discomfort a little bit. And you're right that there may be a judgment going on as well, and that's something which makes it worse, the thinking that sort of makes that judgment or that visceral feeling worse, you know. So if you can try and just sort of let the judgment quieten down, that's really helpful. And that's why something like this is useful, because what it does is to help you to experience these very spacious states of mind that mindfulness meditation can bring you to, which is more difficult to achieve if you're just practicing mindfulness within an active life, you know. So it is worth sometimes sitting on your cushion and going through the mindfulness process, I think. Any other thoughts before I move on? So, the sutra actually starts by saying, find yourself a nice tree and sit under it. And then it says, and it just says, or a quiet place. But it does say do that, and it says sit with your body erect and set up your mindfulness in front, which is interesting. And then it says, now bring your attention to the breath as it flows in and it flows out. And the way I've got it here, at least, that is the first stage, is simply bringing your attention to the breath. And sometimes we do a lot of preparatory stuff. In fact, I do this quite often before meditating. Maybe do some stretching and some yoga, you know, maybe then sit there and do a whole body scan and various things like that. But you can actually go straight to the breath. It doesn't do any harm to do that. But the body awareness, I think, is a very important aspect of meditation. But you can do it riding on the breath. So you can bring your attention to the breath. Then you notice what it's like. So the first thing you do, you first of all bring your attention to it. That's quite an achievement, first of all, just to do that. You know, just to sort of make sure it's there. And then you notice what it's like. You notice, the way it says, you know, if you're breathing deeply, you notice you're breathing deeply. If your breath is a bit shallow, you notice it's shallow. And by implication, whatever else is going on, you just notice. Not necessarily trying to change it, just noticing it. And it's in these stages that the counting can be helpful. What the counting is doing is helping you to bring your attention to the breath. The original sutta doesn't mention counting at all. Counting is taught in the later commentaries. It goes back like 2,000 years. It's not a recent innovation, but bringing counting into the mindfulness of breathing came after, it seems, the time of the Buddha. Or at least it may have been taught orally, because we know that the more detailed meditation teachings were given by word of mouth from master to disciple or mistress to disciple during those early years until it was written down. So the suggestion with the counting is that 10 is a good number. You don't have to use 10, but 10 is a good number to count to. And the suggestion is that you start counting after. Or you can put it this way, you can count the out-breaths. And then in the second stage, you can count the in-breaths if you want. Yes, Marilyn.
I think it's quite significant about drawing the attention in front.
Yes.
And not behind.
It is interesting, isn't it? Yes.
I suppose you need to know that there's nothing happening.
Yes.
I've got windows in my living room. I've got windows behind, you know, both sides. And so I suppose, you know, I probably would be more comfortable shutting the curtains behind me.
Yes. Or even sitting near a wall, you know, something like that.
Yeah.
Yes. But as I did mention, when we came to the experiencing the body stage, I suggested you might actually want to bring your attention to your back at that point, because it can be a part of us that we neglect. Mm. You know, it's sometimes where our attention is too much in front, and we're constantly sort of chasing that bubble of braininess that is sort of hovering around there sometimes in front of our eyes, and our eyes become tired and so on. But setting up intention, your attention in front may also refer to the sense of being aware of that air, that volume of air that's flowing in and out, which after all is coming from in front of you.
How about if you're not closing your eyes, staring at a certain object, and then would it be the same effect that you do your mindfulness breathing?
You can try it if you like. I mean, when they do mindfulness breathing in Zen monasteries, they will do it with their eyes open, but then they'll sit facing a blank wall. So if you have too many distracting objects in front of you, it may be good if you're sleepy, but it may be a little bit too distracting. But you can try it. You can see what happens. So we're bringing our attention to the breathing. We're noticing what it's like. We're just noticing its qualities. And we're starting to take an interest in it. And you need to do this, don't you? In a way, you might feel, what could be more boring than the breathing? It's going on all the time. It's always the same. It's always the same oxygen-nitrogen mix that's pouring in with a little bit of extra carbon dioxide as it comes out. You know, what's interesting about that? But it can be. Has anyone ever found it is actually interesting, the breath? You found it interesting, yeah. Sometimes you can find it interesting, can't you?
I find that actually sometimes the counting can be distracting. Yes.
And I think one of the skills in mindfulness of breathing, as you become more adept at it, is knowing when to count and when to stop counting. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to follow the rule of, oh, it's another 5 minutes isn't up yet, so I mustn't stop. But I think that for newcomers, I'd usually suggest that they do keep the counting going, even if they don't feel like it, because the county might be annoying to them simply because it's forcing them not to take an interest in their distractions, you know, and they don't like the fact they keep losing count. But yes, you can, and you can start, as I suggested this time, just keep on counting. Rather than stopping at 10, you just keep on counting until the signal goes to the next stage. But yes, you're right, the counting can itself be a distraction, because it's the breath that you're trying to attend to. And the counting is only there to help you to bring your attention to the breath and notice if your attention has wandered. And if you don't need that, then you don't need the counting and you can throw it away. So after bringing your attention to it, noting what it's like, the next thing is you experience the body, the whole breathing body. And in a way, there are lots of ways of doing this, but this can be a body, the body awareness phase, when you really make sure you're in tune with your physical self, you feel at home with your body, you know, that you you inhabit it fully. You feel happy with it as best as you can, you know, because sometimes we don't have a very good relationship with our body. We're annoyed about it getting ill or growing old or getting flabby or something. And we've got to actually say to ourselves, this is the precious vehicle, as the Tibetans say, that is carrying me through my life. And I have to, there's no point, you know, if your car goes wrong, there's no point going up to it and swearing at it and kicking it, is there? You've got to actually look after it and fix it, you know, and give it some petrol. And the same goes to the body as well. You need to look after it and be kind to it. And that spirit of kindness is there in that experiencing the body phase of mindfulness of breathing. Just sort of having the body completely there and say, ah, yes, that's nice. That is nice. Nice to feel alive, isn't it? You know, nice to feel the energy flowing, the energy moving. And all of these stages, it all says, in the sutta, it all says, breathing in, he or she experiences the body. Breathing out, he or she experiences the body. So it's riding the breath. The breath is there the whole time. Whatever else you're doing, the breath is there. The breath is, in a way, dominating your experience. So once you've experienced the body for a while, and again, if you're being intuitive, and if you've got plenty of time, you can just give it whatever time it seems to need. And maybe even think, actually, I need to get up and do a bit of stretching, you know, and then sit down again, you know, or I need to lie down at this point, you know, because I'm getting stiff. So the next thing is calming the body formations. Now, I couldn't quite work out what to put down there, so I thought I'd just put it down sort of relatively literally. But what it means is that all the influences, the disturbances, the experiences that are basically physical that are happening in your experience, which includes sensory experiences, by the way. It includes the sounds that are coming in and so on. Everything that is sort of physical and material that's happening in your experience as you sit there meditating. And what's that? You calm it down. So it may be, literally, that you've got some agitation, that you can feel yourself fidgeting or scratching or moving unnecessarily. And you see if you can just sit as still as you can. If you need to shift into a better position, do that, but don't get into the habit of every minute shifting again. You know, maybe that means you just need to lie down or something like that, you're just not comfortable. So if you can, you go to stillness at this point, and you do whatever is necessary, whatever helps you to calm the body formations, to calm those influences and disturbances and experiences that are in the body. Better, they're not necessarily, I call them disturbances, but they might be really nice. You know, it might be that you're, I mean, just to take a rather coarse example, it might be you're getting really randy as you sit there. That is a body formation. And it's something that if you want to be randy, you can be randy. But if you want to meditate, then in a way you need to let that calm down so that you're able to sort of, in a way, make the body gradually less dominant in your experience. So you start very fully experiencing the body. But as you move through these, you want the body to be less of a distraction. So that's why you're calming the body formations. And those are the first four. That's the first. See, usually they're described as being tetrads for a reason I won't go into now. But they're divided into four sequences of four, these stages in Anapanasati. So we've finished the first set. Yes?
I'm trying not to ask this question, but I really want to know the answer. And I'd be very interested to know whether anyone else feels this. But it's such a given, noticing the breath. But sometimes I find it very difficult because
yes.
It's a bit like the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. The minute you start noticing the breath, it changes the breath. So I find that I'm not breathing normally, and then I think, well, I should be breathing normally, and then suddenly I think, I haven't got enough breath, and so I have to go, and I think I'm not expelling all my breath, and it all becomes such a chore, and I don't know whether anyone else...
Does that happen? Is that as bad now as it was when you started, would you say? Is it always similar?
I think it's been similar. I think I worry about it less.
Yes.
But it is something I sort of thought I would take, as this is so centred on the breathing, I thought I'd actually raise it, because you never really get into the body either, because then you become aware of your body kind of going, I haven't got enough oxygen, and then you think, and then you become very aware of your chest and its movement, and I don't know whether that's part of the process or...
Well, it's a body disturbance. It is one of the body disturbances that can happen. Is that sort of thing, where you're not sure about your breathing is changing, you're changing it, and so on. That is a body formation. And so, therefore, to find ways of calming that formation is very important, very valuable if you can do that. You have to do it yourself, in a way. You have to find out what's going to work yourself. But others may have suggestions as to what can work. Anyone got any tips?
It does happen to me, because sometimes you suddenly realise that, and I need to take a deep breath, because... You haven't done this for a while, then you say, oh, no, I want to do a deep breath. Then you started to breathe in very deeply, and then after that, you just lapse it.
I mean,
so
I would suggest...
very regular, the breathing.
I would suggest practicing abdominal breathing, but I'm sure you're aware of abdominal breathing, I should imagine, aren't you? But if you can practice that, and if you can practice concentrating on the out-breath with abdominal breathing, so... No, concentrate on the in-breath. So push your abdomen out and see if you can let the breathing entirely... you are very much controlling the breathing at this stage. And so see if you can just allow the abdomen to push the breath so that it flows in. So your abdomen is going out, the breath is flowing in, And then just relax and let the breath naturally flow out. So that at the moment you're controlling, but you're only controlling the in-breaths. And do that a little bit more deeply and deliberately than usual. In fact, I think that a bit of deliberate breathing can be very useful in these first two stages. We always tell people to breathe naturally, because it's important that we don't get complete beginners doing pranayama exercises and going off their heads, you know. Then you're experienced people, and you don't have to do that. You don't have to breathe naturally. You can actually breathe artificially, deliberately artificially, at the beginning of the practice. And to do that, breathe a little bit more deeply and deliberately than usual, and use your abdomen as much as possible. That's what I would suggest. Mm. Now, probably, at least sometimes, you'll find that that will give you... Then you'll feel, I don't need to do that anymore. My breath has come to a rhythm. I can let it be what it wants to be. I'm not going to stop breathing. I'm going to get enough oxygen. It's absolutely fine. And you'll probably find that if you do that for a while. But if you don't, then just do a bit of deep breathing for a while, that's fine.
Yeah.
And then let it happen again. Well, it won't do any harm doing some deep breathing.
No, I know that what I try to tell myself is that the body will breathe in.
Oh, yeah.
It's a reflex. So
yes, you're not going to die. No. You're not going to die through lack of oxygen.
So sometimes
I've never heard of anybody dying during the mindfulness of breathing because they stop breathing.
Yet.
You might be the first.
It's a bit like anxiety.
It's more self. I believe me. I'm not frightened of admitting to anxiety. It is definitely something I contend with. But no, in this particular instance, it really is just a self consciousness. It's the minute I start looking at the breath, it's no longer natural. But we can't stay in the state where we're just breathing and not aware of it. There's got to be some way of being in the middle of that where the breathing is natural and not.
So this is what happens when you get the calming of the body formations.
Yeah.
That means that at that point you'll find your breathing is natural, but you're also aware of it. You can let it happen, you don't need to control it, but you can be fully aware of it. And it's a delightful experience, it's lovely to be able to do that. And if you're not getting it very much, then do more mindfulness of breathing.
Okay.
Do more of it, do it for longer and do it more often.
Right.
And you can't maintain that artificial breathing for very long, you know.
I had the same thing. I used to have lots of anxiety at the beginning, and I think it got worse if I thought about it.
Mm-hmm.
So one day I did it backwards. And I started concentrating externally by just concentrating on the breath coming in. And because I was concentrating on a small area, so my concentration was on my nose, but actually I was aware of the breath. Right. So it was just giving my mind a little... just a tiny fraction, yeah, by being
that's
at the nose.
That's a good idea, I think, yeah.
And
the
then
opposite
I was
of
able... And then after a while, yeah, I can kind of move it around. Mm. But yeah, I would have it awfully. At one point, I couldn't actually do the first stage. I had to just drop that.
And it is something you should be prepared to do, as I said, is to dive in at one of the later stages if you wish to, because this stage, experiencing the whole body, it's best if your breath is quite deep and down here.
Yeah.
But for the stage of calming the body formations, at that point you want the breath, your experience of the breath, to be more subtle. And that's why you bring it, this is the traditional method, you bring it up here to the contact point instead and let that little tickle be the main thing that that is happening. And just as if there's this great river of air or tide of air that's just going over that point and then over that point coming out again. The way that one of the great Buddhist meditation teachers, Buddha Gosha, describes it is watching sawing a piece of wood and just keeping your eye at the point where the saw blades go over the wood. And that's the place, that's that place where the saw is the air and the wood is your body. Yeah.
Mm. It's very interesting you say that, actually, because that's where Vipassana starts.
Yes.
When you do Vipassana, the very first thing you do is focus on
go straight to there, yeah. Yes. So they jump ahead a little
perhaps
bit.
I should try.
Yeah. But yes, you can do absolutely no harm at all doing that in the first stage.
Thank you.
Okay. So going through the first four, then these naturally unfold from each other, but they won't necessarily do so. But they do naturally follow on. And so the natural thing that follows on from calming the body formations is that you will tend to feel more together. You'll feel more united as a person. You'll just feel the whole of you is there now. You know, you've gone through your body, but you've also calmed the disturbances of your body, and you've got into a more subtle experience. And that can be absolutely delightful. And it's very important, I think, to enjoy whatever enjoyment arises in the meditation. You can't manufacture it, but it's in a way, it is an important element. And sometimes you can sort of miss it or think, oh no, I'm going for the insight, so therefore I won't mention that bit. But if you can get to that delighted interest and just give a bit of space to say, is there anything in my experience at the moment that is quite nice? And say, oh yeah, oh there is, isn't there? Yeah, and then go for that. Actually give that more prominence in your mind, that enjoyment. Even get a bit excited about it. So, wow, this is really nice, isn't it? Oh, I think it's lovely. And I mentioned relief, the sense of, isn't that wonderful? I can just sit here. Nobody's demanding anything of me. I don't have to do anything or achieve anything. I can just sit here and just follow my breathing. How wonderful that is, you know. So if you can get that delighted interest, that's really fantastic. And that's called pritti. Pritti is the traditional name for it. Delighted interest or something like that. Engagement. And then what that naturally unfolds into is contentment. And there is an intermediate phase, which isn't mentioned in this sutta, which is the one of calming down or of tranquility. So the excitement of the enjoyment is nice, but you say, okay, let's just let that die down a bit. And let's just sort of sit there a little bit more spaciously, you know, not getting so excited about it all, just spacious, open, calm. And that's called sukha, contentment. Yeah. So we're moving through these stages, and you need to go into that, because if you stay in this stage, you haven't really got a chance for these more deep, as it were, purely mental experiences, because the excitement is keeping you too physical. And you may get, has anyone ever had that in meditation, where they've actually felt trembling or crying or tingling, you know, anything, anyone had that sort of thing? Or feeling very light? Or feeling very heavy or big.
Just this close from giggling, I think, in the middle of that.
Giggling, yeah, absolutely. I mean, laughter is great. That laughter is this phase. And it's okay to laugh while you're meditating. It's okay to laugh even if you're in the middle of a room of other people meditating. So you don't need to inhibit it if that starts to happen. It's also okay to cry as well. And they're not very different from each other. The crying and the laughter can both be aspects of this pratti arising. And so they're absolutely fine if they happen in meditation. It's quite good just to allow them to flow, to have a sense of just flow and openness and experience going. It's organic, this. Although this makes it look rather mechanical, this. Actually, that's not what our experience is like. And we may just find ourselves, at some point, quite unexpectedly, being in the delighted interest phase and weeping uncontrollably. And that's fine. That's absolutely fine.
Did you mention feeling big?
I did, yeah. Have you had that one?
Yeah, I had that tonight. I just felt like...
Yes.
Huge.
Yes. Yes, I mean, those feelings, they can be just to do with that sense of excitement, but they can also be a deeper thing. They can also be what's called a nimitta. And a nimitta means a sign of entering a deeper phase of concentration. So feeling very big is one of those common signs that can mean that you're moving from one type of consciousness to another type of consciousness. And it's quite good to look out. Everyone will have their own signs of that movement. And as you get more adept at meditation, you'll notice what is it for you that tends to give you a little signal, oh, I'm on the edge of a deeper phase. You know, oh, that's quite nice, isn't it? I'll follow that. I'll let myself get really big. And then I'll find myself sitting there maybe, you know, in that deeper, very deep state. It can be how you experience the breath. It may be suddenly the breath seems to be not just air, but also light. So as if the breath is actually, you can see it in your mind's eye. You can see sparkling breath going like a balloon going, you know. I don't want to suggest these things too much, because you might then start to mind manufacture them. It's completely spontaneous, and it's not something that you can make happen. And it's very different from person to person. And for some people, it would be very, very unspectacular, where you just plod on, you just do your practice, and it's absolutely fine, and it does you a lot of good, but you feel a bit jealous of those people that get very big, or float off through the window, or something. What do we do? Okay, so delight and interest, contentment. Now, the next thing you look at, we've looked at body formations, now we look at the mind formations, and we do this in two stages, because they're more subtle. We actually, first of all, simply become aware of the mental disturbances. And again, I say disturbances. They might be quite pleasant stuff, but there are things going on in the mind. Whatever it is that is coming in and out of the mind, thoughts and memories, hindrances, you know, longings and doubts and irritations and sleepiness, all these kind of things. These are the mental formations. These are to do with your state of mind, and they are things that are influencing your state of mind. So the first thing you do is you see whether, having gone through this, you're feeling quite contented with any luck. You're feeling quite spacious. So you can just say, okay, now that I'm feeling quite contented and spacious, I can now open to whatever's going on in my mind. And this is where the unwelcome comes in. Because you're in this stage, it's much easier to allow what is unwelcome to be present. And there may be things that you've been avoiding for a while. You know, there might, just to take a fairly sort of extreme example, and maybe somebody close to you has died and you haven't had the chance to really experience the grief properly. So it could be that the mind formations that are there wanting to come in but have been too sort of held at bay because you've not been feeling you can cope with them. Now this may be the chance when you can just say, I'll just experience that grief. I'll let that grief be there. Or those memories. I'll let the memories be there and notice them. But if you can, you stay with the breath as you do this. So it's not something that's completely taking you away. The breath is still there. That really wonderful anchor of the breath is still there. While you experience the grief or the memories or the dissatisfaction or even the anger with people that might be there, you know, just notice it here. And give that its own time, what time it seems to need. And then when you feel ready, and you may leave this to another session before you come to the next one, which is calming the mind formations. So here, you find ways in which you can let those mental disturbances become smaller and your whole mental state become bigger. So you see whether your mind can just become more spacious. And the disturbances may still be there, but they're just getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And I can't really tell you how to do that, because you have to find out your own way. of doing it. It's to do with understanding your own mind and what it's up to, really.
Well, certainly in my development of the meditation, the mind formations came much earlier. And I've had to sort of learn to be with the body first,
and then
with the mind. And so so now it's following that.
That's interesting, isn't it?
But the mind was wouldn't stay out in the beginning.
And in fact, it will be. It's not that it will definitely be there in the beginning. It's more that the sort of the step by step approach is to deal with the physical first and not worry too much about the mental. Yeah. But it could be that the mental is so strong that it prevents you from experiencing the physical properly.
That's right.
There's so much stuff going on that you can't really get into your body. Yeah. And so you may need to calm the mental down a bit before you can fully experience the physical.
Yeah.
Once you've got the physical, you can move through these stages until you get to contentment. Mm. And then you can say, okay, let's go back to the mental again now.
Yeah.
Let's go back to that, you know. But yeah, that's right. And again, you jump in, you may jump in at a different point. Mm. But you'll have those mental disturbances will be there right at the beginning. It's not that they're not there. Mm. It's just that it's more difficult to deal with them if you've also got fidgeting and disturbance in your body, you know. And they're very closely connected as well, of course. You can't really say they're either mental or physical, because every mental state has a physical expression, doesn't it? And every physical state has effects in the mind. They're very closely connected with each other.
And that's why you need to calm your body.
Yes, yes.
For me, once I do that, and people say that you are experiencing it, I always feel very grounded.
Yes.
When I sit, so when my body is calm, automatically my mind is calm.
And that's why when Paramananda teaches here, he'll often put a lot of emphasis on just learning to sit still. Learning to get your posture right and to stay still. Just
very
doing that is an incredible achievement, to do that. And that's dealing on this level with the body formations and experiencing the body. So, if we can calm our mind down a bit, then we can go back again, not just experiencing the mind formations, but experiencing the mind itself. So, in a way, we're there in that spacious mental state, and we can just have a sense of the size of the mind, of how spacious it is, how huge it is, how it doesn't really have any boundaries, how light it is, how illuminated it is, or can be at least, how alive it can be. And we just notice the whole mind. We experience or sensitive to the whole chitta, is the way it says it in the sutta. The chitta being the mind and the heart. So it's not mind just in the sense of brain. It's the emotional and thinking part of you. So we experience the mind. Once we've got that, this is very interesting. We go back again to the positivity. And it's interesting, the sutta doesn't let you let go of that. It says, come on, enjoy yourself again. It's important that you get back to that positive mental state. But this is gladdening the mind. Gladdening the mind. And there are a lot of ways of doing the gladdening the mind. You're trying to make it, as it were, a purely mental gladdening. So rather than getting all excited in the body, you're now trying to stay very calm, but produce a sense of deep satisfaction or gladness. It might just be going back again to contentment. That might be what you're doing here. But it's important that you keep on, you know, reviving the contentment. If you go straight too quickly into insight, then actually it can be very difficult to cope with. So you need to make sure you're in this very buoyant state if you possibly can. And what I do at this stage is some metta-bhavana. So I think the gladdening the mind, the best way to do it, is especially self-metta, is just to have that sense of kindness, warmth, and so on towards yourself. But maybe think of others as well at that stage. You know,
it's for me, it's just come naturally.
Yes.
That when you think about your mind and they're spacious, and automatically you are so. Feel metta for yourself, and all of a sudden you connect with the world.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It comes very naturally at this stage. The gladdening of the mind.
Yeah.
Again, it's an organic process,
and
in a way, all you need to do is open to that
possibility
of being filled with metta. Mm. And in a way, it's quite a good. You can do all this as a preparation for metta bhavana if you want to.
Yeah.
And then if you can get to something like this stage, I mean, it never happened completely perfectly, but something like this stage, you think, yeah, that's really nice, isn't it? And you just think of your friend and quite naturally think, oh, wow, they love you. I'm so glad I know that person. So gladdening. And then after gladdening comes unifying. So once you're reasonably positive, you can now say, okay, let me marshal my resources, let me get the energy of the mind moving, because I'm now preparing to move into insight, to looking at what is really deeply going on. And to do that, I need a properly focused mind. So this is unifying or even concentrating the mind at this point, getting it into a flow, a real flow, so it's ready for the next stage.
You're still with the breath at this stage.
You're still with all of these, every single one of these. It says, so it'll say, breathing in, one unifies the mind. Breathing out, one unifies the mind. And it says it right to the last one of the 16. And then the next one is releasing or liberating. So this is just lovely at this point, absolutely wonderful. And you just say, okay, it's flowing, it's happy. Let's just let go. Let's just sort of start flapping little wings and take off or something like that. I don't quite know how to put it, but actually I did say something when I was leading through. I haven't what it was.
But yes. Go of a bird into the blue sky.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah,
yes.
This is lovely. Yeah. Couldn't do it, but it's lovely.
Top of the lakes and
yeah.
Stars. And
so it is that sense, really, of realising, I don't have to hold on anymore. I don't have to do that anymore. It's okay just to let the buoyancy, the natural buoyancy of the mind, let me open up in that way. So it's really the brink of insight, this one, the brink of insight practice. And in fact, traditionally, all of these are said to be a combination of calming meditation and insight meditation. But the last four become pure insight meditation. You've done all the calming now, and now you can really look at reality as closely as you can. And I can't really say much about these, but the first one is impermanence. So your mind now released, at least to some extent, you've let your mind go, and you can just allow it to look around it and see how everything, like the breath, is following these wonderful rhythms. Everything is being breathed in, but it's also being breathed out. So it's as if the breath itself is giving you a message about impermanence, giving you a message about the fact that everything is changing the whole time. So that's very beautiful at that stage. And then the one after this, viraga, is disentangling, the disentangling process, where you realise as you look, you're relatively liberated, you've noticed the flow, and you notice there are bits that are still sticky. There are bits, I've still got some Velcro on one or two spots. What can I do? And you sort of start to, I'm still caught up in the blackberry bush a bit, and you start to pull the little thorns out, and you start to sort of just, that. This is the disentangling process. You realise, and I don't know if this makes sense, but we all have got ourselves tangled up in all sorts of things. And most of the time, we experience the unpleasant consequences of that, but we don't really experience the fact we're tangled up. You need quite a lot of this spaciousness through meditation to just notice the tangles that you got yourself in. And so at this point, you start to do some disentangling. And this might take you 50 years.
Yeah.
Don't think this is something you're just going to do during your meditation session.
I'm dead.
I don't have 50 years.
You better hurry up in that case.
2 years at least. Disentangle, you use metta.
Yes.
I think the last four stage is going to take at least 30 or 40 years to master, isn't it? Because it's very abstract, this thing, you know? It's not easy.
It might, but on the other hand, it might just happen in a flash. It might happen in one flash. All of this, you just find yourself going, whoosh. It doesn't mean you're enlightened, but it means that you've seen it, you've seen through it. Something very deep has happened where you've seen through your entangling processes, you know. And as you say, you do it with metta, but you also do it with vision. You do it with trying to open to what you're doing and say, do I really need to do that? Because the entangling, it's not just like you've got something knotted and it's been like that for years. You keep on tangling the knots. You keep on doing it. And if you stop doing it, they'll naturally undo.
You mean something has been deeply troubled
in your mind and you do not notice that. So at that stage, you can actually automatically dissolve it?
If you see it, you'll automatically dissolve it. The more deeply you see it, the more you'll dissolve it.
Yeah.
So you just need to, all you need to do is notice it fully. But of course, it can be very disturbing to notice it. So this is why you go through all this samatha, this calming phase, so that you're in a good positive frame of mind. And you might just notice a bit of it and think, actually, I can't quite cope with that at the moment. I mean, just to give you an example, and, you know, again, a relatively extreme example, I mentioned grief about somebody else dying, but there's also facing up to your own death. So this might be the kind of thing that happens here. You realise that when you confront the reality of your own future death, you realise you're tangled up. And you realise that you can't quite accept it. And it may be you're not ready for that. And you say, okay, later, I'll deal with that later. But it may be, going through this, you are ready for that. And you can just look right face to face at impermanence, and you can say, I can disentangle from that. It's not a problem anymore. It's not. It doesn't need to be a problem.
And just two questions on that. Do you actually consciously bring whatever entanglement that you're in to your mind?
And yes.
So X, Y, Z. Think about it.
That's right.
Do you have any tips in speeding it up?
Seriously.
Yes.
No, I mean, first of all, I haven't done it, you know, so I can't speak from the experience of somebody who's managed to do the disentangling and can tell you from the other side, you know, how you go about it. You know, the little I understand about it, it does seem to me the more of this preparation you can do, the more likely you are to be able to do some quick disentangling. So the more positivity you've got, the more spaciousness and calmness of mind you've got, the more likely you are. But it may just happen. You can't choose it. And it might be that a very strong experience of impermanence and the necessity to disentangle might come up, you know, just because of a crisis, you know, because you've got a sack or something, you know, and you haven't got the leisure to sit there and go through all this meditation. You say, okay, here's a chance to do some disentangling. It's going to be really tough, but I'm going to see if I can do it. I'm going to watch the reaction. I'm going to watch what my mind does here. I've just been given a sack. I'm really annoyed. It's very unfair, all that kind of stuff. Okay, go through all that stuff, you know. I'm feeling very sorry for myself. I feel very anxious about people. Watch all that happening and say, now, can I just open a bit? Can I start to sort of see some of those little tangles that I'm forming in this? Because a crisis is a great time, I think, for this to happen. So a crisis is a wonderful gift. So to be given a crisis is something you should be incredibly grateful for.
Consider crisis is a gift.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh.
Somebody who never has crises, they'll probably never make much progress.
But if too many, that's not good, is it?
Too many is difficult, very difficult to cope with. Yeah. You just need, ideally they want to come one at a time with a bit of a gap between them.
You can't arrange this happening.
No, you can't control it. It has to be outside your control.
So just about the crises, they do come one at a time. That's my experience.
Usually they do, yes.
And they're very intense.
Yes.
That's the challenge, it seems,
yes.
to be able to separate from the intensity as the crisis, as you fall into the crisis, to somehow separate, like you were just describing, is extremely... It's got you anyway.
Yeah, that's right, yes.
So... But I guess how deep one ends up in it,
yes.
The effects, effectively, that's the challenge. But I hear what you're saying is to be able to work with it.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't know what you can do with it. You have to work it out for yourself, but it might be that the crisis arrives and you go through, you realise you're going to have to go through with all those reactions and things, and then you have enough presence of mind to say, okay, I'm just going to sleep on this. And when I get up tomorrow morning, I'm just going to let it be present in my mind for a while and maybe take a few notes, just have a notebook there, see what comes out as I write it, or draw a picture or something, let it come out in some way that isn't too much under my control and just see what happens. Or even just talk to somebody about it who's not going to try and solve it for you, who's not going to blame you for it, who's not going to blame other people for it, who just listen properly. I don't know. Those are a number of ways you might want to do it. And it might be that through that, you'll be able to do some disentangling, even maybe the next stage, which is stopping Nirodha. Stopping is, you know, once you've done the disentangling, it's the in a way. It's just the moving away from all that ego involvement. And that's called Nirodha stopping. And then finally, the last one here is called letting go.
Does it have to be a crisis, though, or can it be a recognition of a pattern that is repetitive, that is not working for you?
No, it doesn't have to be a crisis.
So it can be a recognition of a pattern of behaviour at a given moment in time.
Even if you don't understand
the mechanics of it, you can suddenly say, well, this is the same situation.
I've done it before, and I now recognise it doesn't work.
Yeah.
It does not work. And you don't know what does work, but you know that doesn't work.
Yeah.
And then you can start to disentangle.
So that's another opportunity to disentangle.
It's another opportunity, I mean, in fact, everything, you sitting here now is an opportunity for disentangling. There's no time when there's not an opportunity for disentangling. The only reason I mentioned crises is because, in a way, you've got to do something if there's a crisis there. And there's a possibility of being really creative with it. But there's always an opportunity there's always an opportunity for mindfulness, and there's always an opportunity for doing the disentangling, I think.
I'm so pleased that letting go is at the end of all of this.
Yes.
Because so often you hear this phrase, oh, just kind of let it go. Yeah. And you feel a bit bad, like, oh, why do I keep going back to it? I don't seem to be able to let it go. And now I know.
Letting go is the hardest thing.
It's the end bit.
Isn't it? Yeah.
Actually, there's like a whole thing that I can do that's, it's really nice. It's like, just let it go. It's like,
It's easier said than done, isn't it?
You
think let it go is only temporary or permanent?
I think let it go is a ridiculous thing to say when someone's struggling. I think that what this process is about bringing it in and really welcoming it and experiencing it. And moving around it and all sorts of things.
So you've got a lot
real
more to
process
do.
That then allows you to mentally and physically let it go, but actually it's now an aspect of you understanding that.
So that
huge thing.
Griefness or whatever, just let it go for that period of time.
Well, I think you've got let it go, which is like, oh yeah, just let it go, which is definitely, I would say, is short-lived, because it's nonsense. And then at the end of this
whole process. You could do some of these other things with that, so that, maybe I'm not ready to let go yet. Maybe I just need to feel it in my body for a while. And then, in a way, feel as I feel it more thoroughly in my body, to feel the wonderful sense of excitement and release that comes through letting it be there and not holding it back,
And let it go also, you can't force.
No, you can't
it
force
has
it.
To, everything has to come naturally. Otherwise, if you force something, you're stuck again. So it has to, just everything you have to experience, and then it comes. When you are ready, then you will let it go, whatever is there.
It's not very, but you're right, it's said an awful lot, isn't it? Oh, just let it go, let it go. It's like, don't worry. Don't worry and let it go. Yes. Two things. I want to shoot people who say that. if someone came up with a pill to not worry and to be able to let
it
go.
Well, even just saying relax.
Oh,
it's all very well to say relax, isn't it?
And have you ever tried saying calm down to someone who's really angry?
Yeah.
It only makes the situation worse. So
relax, it's well worse, just relax.
Yes.
But I think that what you're saying is true. When you say that, there's the transitory thing, which is a very superficial sort of intellectual idea of, well, I'm not going to worry about this, I'm going to let it go. But that's not what this is. This is a deep process of appreciation of what the problem is and
so
it's to let it go.
What impression do you have of this? Do people have of this? Does it feel... Can you relate to it? Does it feel like an organic process? Because I have the sense that it is one of the Buddha's most profound teachings, in a way. He's got many approaches he gives to people, many, many approaches. And this is one in particular as to how you can use simply the breath to take you through all this stuff. And to go through it again and again and again, and to home in on bits of it. But there's a lot of really useful advice, I think, there on...
It's very systemic.
Systematic.
Systematic, sorry, not systemic. And, there's a method.
Yes, it is, yes.
Well, it's quite a lot for one session. I mean, you know.
Can we do it again?
In a half an hour.
Seriously, not now. But I mean, could we have another session? Because it is a lot.
It is, isn't it? Yeah.
It was.
Yeah, try it again sometime.
Yeah.
Yes.
It was. It's really useful.
Yes.
Yeah, I think it's well worth learning all those steps because it doesn't necessarily come naturally in the sense that it will one step will follow the other without being taught it. Naturally, one skips, I think, about.
If you are interested in...
Before you're helped to see how things develop logic, not so much logic, yes, as a whole person development.
That's right, yes.
Follows these steps. And if you... teach yourself to continue to follow these steps, it will come naturally.
Yes.
So that when you're entangled, you can say to yourself, I've got to meditate on this. And then in the process of meditating on the problem, you go through all those steps. And then you're ready at the end to let go, maybe, if you can go through the whole thing.
Yes. Now, we do have to finish now, I'm afraid. It's 25-2. But just to round things off a little bit, I'll just say that if you do want to explore it more, you really need to do it on retreat.
Yeah.
Because it is too complex, really, to take you through in a one three-quarters of an hour session. Mm. You know, I wanted to do that to try and give you a bit of experience of it, but it really needs to be a retreat. So if you look for a mindfulness retreat of some kind, if you want to explore it yourself, there are lots of good books on it, but I'll mention one in particular, Larry Rosenberg's Breath by Breath. So he takes you through the process. Mm-hmm. Larry Rosenberg is an American teacher. And we do have that, I think, in the bookshop.
Yes, we
so, have Breath by Breath by Larry Rosenberg is a good introduction to this.
And there are retreats that are based on this.
There are retreats. System. Yeah, you'll find those retreats if you look carefully. Yeah.
And I know that Goloka has.
Yeah, so look out for that word, Anapanasati, mindfulness of breathing.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.